Everyone for coming. This is my first book, and it's not yet published, and so this is my first reading, and so I'm quite excited. And it's a book about what happens when a medical student inherits a very special football club that she doesn't want. And it follows a quite large cast of characters through 7 years. I consciously wanted to write a saga because where lots of stuff happens, because that's the kind of book I like reading, and so it's a twisty, turny narrative with various catastrophes and disasters. And the setting for it is very important. It is set within this football club, but it's not a football club like any football club that exists at present. I don't know what you know about the origins of what we call football, but in the mid-19th century, a lot of clubs were set up as sort of philanthropic organisations by do-gooding Christian missionaries. And so they set up these clubs in the centre of towns to ennoble the working man by giving him something to do and a way to interact with rules and all of this kind of thing. And then the game almost immediately went beyond the control of these missionary figures and was destroyed by money, in their view, and became a thing for fans to watch, really. And I wanted to see if there was any way I could have one of these clubs survive into something like the modern day, and the only way I could imagine that happening was if it had a lot of money behind it. And so what there is in this book is the story of an aristocratic Irish family who in the mid-19th century set up a utopian business empire in Kilburn, where I live, which is excellent, and the football club is part of that. And so obviously you can tell from that it's set in an alternate present rather than a specific present. And I think that's important from my perspective because I didn't want anyone coming into the book trying to identify things. So there's no Tony Blair and there's no David Beckham. All the people in it are made up. But I hope, on the other hand, that the dilemmas and the situations in which they find themselves are recognisable. And the story starts at a party, and they're at a moment at a party. And during this party, the protagonists coincide, and it's a very important moment in the history of the club for reasons that most of them don't realise. And we see this moment from various of their different perspectives, including, and I'm going to start with, the perspectives of two people who have left the party and are going home. And one of them is Mr. Brown, the enigmatic guru manager figure who is dying and hasn't told anyone. And the other is Terrible Zondeki, who is one of the players, who is a South African who was a freedom fighter during the apartheid era and was brought across to England by Mr. Brown, and who plays for the Kilburn Social Club alongside his boyfriend, Achilles. If the socialists didn't exist, we would have to invent them. That's what the journalist had said, and it was wrong, because you couldn't build the socialists without the socialists' history as a foundation. But the journalist's words had stung Mr. Brown into being harsh and gnomic, which had only succeeded in irritating the journalist, which was unnecessary. The socialists, as built by Brown, played a flowing and joyful game, expressing themselves with a precision and verve that was quite foreign to the blood and thunder directness of traditional English football. They were a good thing, and no one else could have made them. Wasn't that enough? After all, nothing lasts forever, but what if the socialists were just a personality cult, a vain old man's dream, doomed to disintegrate when the great leader disappeared? It was more vanity to think like this, but it contained some truth. Brown had been trying to prepare Achilles, but the Argentinian was his own man, and the money cascading into football from satellite TV was changing the game just as Manus said it would. Achilles would have his own challenges to face. Brown was glad that Achilles had Zondi. Zondi was the other man walking home alone. His real name was Terrible Zondeki, and he was not the kind of hero other footballers are. In spite of what the English might call the warmth, he wore his long leather coat and a dark woolly hat. He had found that when he dressed like this and looked down, no one ever seemed to recognise him, and the thought gave him power. He felt like Cam Owl, the owl who was born when the eagle fought with her shadow. Zondi loved to walk, to feel the distance disappear under his short elastic stride. He never got lost. He had lived in the city for many years now, and he had drawn its landscape secretly in his mind from the basking hippopotamus Hampstead, whose head was Primrose Hill, down to the chameleon smile of the Thames and into the south, whose Brixton, Balham, Lambeth and Battersea were a great flock of birds, each named and known. Zondi missed the country of his childhood, parts of which he could still traverse through the stories he had learnt from his mother and his aunts. Long after the stories, he had made himself remember them, and he had used them to visit the lake in the gecko's eye, and he had found the caves at the tip of the long string of low bluffs that made the monkey's tail. But the living country was dying now, along with his people, and all that was left was geography and his own pathetic private version of how they thought. What sense was it to fix the A5 as the route by which the buffalo migrate, or picture Oxford Street as a procession of ants carrying leaves? He had distilled his culture into a mnemonic. The pent-up song in his legs was not anger with the reporter, who was nothing. He turned left automatically, not breaking stride, as he headed alongside the garden in the middle of yet another of London's tiny squares. Zondi's city was many animals, but it was also the body of a great and infinite leopard, and each square was one of her spots. Zondi would sometimes discover a new square and have to readjust his map, but that was rare now. He had made this false landscape because he knew he would never go home. He had discussed displacement many times with old Hank, who said that it was just the nature of things. Hank had spent many years assuming he would return to Newfoundland in the end, to spawn and die in the stream where he was born. But he came to understand that he was not swimming free in the open ocean, but was marooned in a great lake, and he'd evolved to fit the lake, and now he could not leave. He was happy, though. Part of the evolution was that he loved the lake. Zondi trusted Hank, and he liked this explanation. And then the story cuts back to the party, and we cut to the reporter who they're talking about, who's an important character because he indicates that this book is as much about hating football as it is about loving it. It's not a book for football fans. Or, you know, I hope they like it too. You know, I hope everyone likes it, but I'm pretty biased. If the socialists didn't exist, thought Callum Horton, we would have to invent them. The line was fucking perfect, and he was going to use it, whatever Brown or Guinevere said. He sipped in such a way that only a careful observer would have noticed how much he drank, and he arranged himself like a man too full of thoughts to need company. Callum had taken the commission to write a feature about the Kilburn Social Club because football was driving him mad. A few years ago, when it was confined to hooligans and sports twats, that was fine. No one expected him to give a shit. But now, all of a sudden, just because of 11 men wearing red, white, blue and green had managed to score more goals than 11 other men who, in real terms, the fans knew just as well, everyone was supposed to go berserk. Callum found this interesting sociologically, but he didn't fall for the bollocks about national camaraderie and the joyful reclamation of the Union flag. The national mood did not suddenly change because Britain started winning, or because the socialists were a tiny bit more skillful, fit or lucky than some indistinguishable bunch of mercenaries hired by Torino. The national mood was linked to an economic upturn and the bubbling, brilliant excitement that after 18 years, the country was bound to boot out a discredited, bankrupt government and usher in a transparently better alternative at the next election. Football was just coincidence. The thing about sport is that millions of people get obsessed with who wins a particular game, but every game is basically the same. Callum knew that fans would never get to grips with this. He'd given up trying to explain that when they said, "But the result matters to me," they were making his point for him. What matters about anything is what people invest in it. He supposed he should be glad that Dave Guinevere was going to get off with Sally. People love to read about star fucking, but he couldn't help being disappointed. It's not that he knew Sally particularly before tonight, but he had thought she was pretty cool. Guinevere was such a lanky gargoyle and such a sanctimonious prick that she was either an idiot or she was doing it for the cachet, and either way, Callum thought less of her. On the upside, apart from pleasing his editor, writing about it would really piss Guinevere off. When they'd spoken a few days ago, when Callum was still well disposed towards him, The footballer had gone on and on about privacy in a way Callum thought was unrealistic, but quite endearing. Callum honestly had set off hoping that writing about the socialists, and wasn't that a smug little label for a bunch of self-satisfied, overpaid narcissists, would be a perfect opportunity to skewer the football hype. The Kilburn players were supposed to be so fucking clever and wonderful and different, such exceptions to the crass materialism that usually hangs around sport, that maybe they would be able to understand alternative points of view. The bar was too noisy for Callum to hear anything, but the group round Aisling still seemed loud. She was beautiful, he had to admit that, but in a way that pissed him off, and a friend of his from college had told him that she was a typical blonde fit bird used to being deferred to. The gaggle of players with her, a preening clique Callum had christened the boy band, which apparently they'd heard about and loved, which was typical, were exactly what he'd always imagined footballers to be. He asked them if they were different from players at other clubs, and they said they absolutely were, because in addition to their sporting prowess, which was considerable, they were the most attractive team in the league. Callum had tried to get beneath the shtick, but he'd seen too many of their type in his life, and his heart wasn't in it. And so that sort of sets up the fact that there are many differing points of view, and Callum is an instigator of certain crises that occur at this moment. And I'm going to finish off by cutting to a moment in a committee meeting of the Rosslare Group, which is this utopian empire. And present at this meeting are Aisling Rosslare, who is the chairman of the group. She inherited the football club, and her little sister Esther, who is basically massively irritated with Aisling all the time, and not without reason, and Esther is mainly interested in the football. Basically, that's all she really cares about. And Donald, who is the guy who is a cousin of theirs, who runs the business, really, and a guy called Adam, who Aisling has brought in to basically to control Donald when he gets a bit excessive. What has happened is that the committee has realised, or has been made to realise, that Donald has overextended the Rosslare Group, and that they are in financial trouble, and they're not sure what to do about it, and Esther is resisting any attempt to break up the Kilburn Social Club and use its assets to get the Rosslare Group out of trouble. And then they have another meeting, which this is, about replacing the dying Mr. Brown. Aisling turns up late, as she always does, and it turns out that they've already decided who they're going to replace him with, a guy called Purnell. "This is bullshit," said Aisling. "I've booked an afternoon off work and the decision's already made. What the hell was the point of this meeting? This was an important, I know it's important to you, Esther, and it's important to KSC, as you so endlessly remind us, but it really isn't important to me. Well, sorry, it's your job. My job is to be a doctor. This is not my job." Aisling wasn't finished. "I knew this meeting would be over in 5 minutes, but you fucking insisted. This was fine for Dad, and when Mr. Brown was still on his game. But this committee knows sod all about running a football club, and I can't keep sitting here and turning up to league meetings like a spare part." "She's going to resign," thought Esther excitedly. "I've taken your word for it that we need someone to help Mr. Brown manage the team, and we can ask Purnell if that's what you want. But I want someone other than the committee doing the everyday stuff at KSC. We need someone whose job is to deal with it and then bring it to us to decide on, as per the rest of the group." "This is a massive decision," said Donald. "Don't try to talk me out of it, and I'm not being dragged back to another meeting. I'm fed up with this crap. I've thought about it very carefully, and it's happening." Esther doubted the thought had been particularly careful, but her heart was in her mouth and her eyes were on the table as she asked, "Should the chief executive be someone from the committee?" "It definitely should," said Donald. He was angling for the job, typically. "Yes," said Aisling. Esther looked down, shyly, and Adam said, "Well, Esther's the one here who knows about football." Aisling cut in, "She knows nothing about business. Esther, no offence." "Okay, Ash, I'll do it," said Donald. "I dare say I could move things around, get the time. I want Adam to do it." Esther thought Adam looked surprised. After all, he had just suggested she run Kilburn, hadn't he? "My problem is I know so little about the football," he said. "I would need some help. You get what help you need, but this is what I've decided. Apart from anything else, it's going to stop Adam from turning into such a boring suit." Adam's face sank when Aisling said that, and Esther guessed that her sister had struck a knife into some weak spot. He was obviously besotted with her, like all the others, and maybe his decision to be a boring suit was the reason she'd given for it never going anywhere. Aisling was so used to getting her own way that she would say anything, no matter how hurtful, when her mind was set on something. And poor Adam agreed that he would take the job on, for a trial period. But, and here he looked earnestly at her, she thought, only if Esther promised to be available for consultation. Esther hid her disappointment, since it wasn't Adam's fault. And she nodded. She didn't mind if Aisling thought Adam was boring. Quiet people of the world unite, she thought. And you know, we're a fifth of the way in, but really nothing's started yet. We're only 2 weeks into the 7-year-long story after that much. But then, you know, the pace changes in various ways, and we follow them through 7 years, and there are a lot of catastrophes. And I mean, there really are a lot of catastrophes. That's the main thing. It's a very catastrophical book. I wanted to write a story with lots of catastrophes. And it's all set against the background of the Kilburn Social Club, which really is very lovely. Will it survive? And if it does survive, in what form will it survive? And what will happen to the people involved in it?